This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Hi, I'm Jamie Busson. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the best way women over 50 can lose weight with personal trainer Igor Klibanov. We'll learn about the secret to stress recovery with integrative neurologist Dr. Jarina Elbers. We'll discover why some women over 40 are pursuing motherhood independently with fertility expert Dr. Ashley Gutman. And lastly, we'll find out how to protect your pets from extreme heat this summer with veterinarian Dr. Carol Osborne. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. A new study has found that middle-aged North Americans are facing more challenges than previous generations. Researchers discovered that people born in the 60s and early 70s report higher levels of loneliness and depression, as well as poorer memory and reduced physical strength. The study, led by psychologist Frank J. Inferna of Arizona State University, examined survey data from 17 countries. Researchers found that these problems are more common in North America than any other wealthy nations, especially Nordic European countries, where midlife health and well-being have improved over time. The study suggests several reasons for the differences compared with many European countries. North America provides less support for families, including fewer childcare programs, parental leave benefits, and financial assistance. Researchers also point to rising income inequality, limited access to affordable healthcare, and increasing financial insecurity. The study found that loneliness has continued to rise among North Americans, while stronger family support systems in other countries appear to help reduce it. Researchers say that stronger social connections and improved public policies could help address these growing challenges for middle-aged adults. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Igor Klibanov in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. You already know the importance of exercise for energy, improved strength, and better mobility. What you really need is an expert to show you how to exercise safely. Receive personalized coaching from Fitness Solutions Plus. Learn safe exercises for osteoporosis, diabetes, chronic pain, and balance issues from a fitness specialist. For a free consultation, visit fitnesssolutionsplus.ca, number one in one-on-one fitness for adults over 50. Igor Klibanov is a personal trainer, author, and founder of Fitness Solutions Plus, where he specializes in helping adults over 50 improve their health through exercise, nutrition, and lifestyle changes. He's been a personal trainer since 2006, has worked with over 1,000 clients, and is the author of 21 books, including 14 Amazon bestsellers on topics like osteoporosis, arthritis, diabetes, and healthy aging. Igor is known for his evidence-based approach to fitness and for translating complex health research into practical, real-world strategies. And for more information about what he does, you can visit fitnesssolutionsplus.ca. And today we're going to talk with Igor about how to lose weight when you're over the age of 50, because that's your new book, right, Igor?
That's right. Very excited to be here. This is a topic that I get asked about very, very often, and this is the first time I'm writing a book about it.
So I'm over 50. I'm not a woman, but I'm also trying to lose weight, and I know what a challenge it is as we get older to drop those pounds. Let's kind of start philosophically. Why do women over 50 gain belly fat, even if they're doing the right stuff like exercising and eating a reasonable diet?
Yeah, great question. So there's a couple of reasons behind it. First of all, we'll talk about location, why the belly specifically. And second of all, why do they gain fat in more broadly speaking?
Yeah.
So let's start with why they gain belly fat specifically. This is just simply a matter of hormones. What happens during menopause is estrogen drops about 90% in a 2-year span, but testosterone only drops 10% in a 2-year span. And so the belly fat is a more testosterone dominant type of fat distribution profile. And also, if a woman was insulin resistant before menopause and then she goes through menopause, she's probably even more insulin resistant. So it's a combination of high relative testosterone and potentially some insulin resistance. So that's why they gain fat specifically in the belly. And sometimes for the women who don't gain fat in general, it's more of a redistribution. They might have the same percentage of body fat, but premenopausally, it was in the buttocks and thighs, and then postmenopause, it's in the belly. Now, some women do actually gain fat over their entire body and more so in their belly. Why would that be? A lot of women blame metabolism. Now, I can't argue that they gain body fat, but I can argue with the attribution. They attribute it to the wrong thing. They think there's only one source of caloric expenditure, and that is their metabolism. But that's not true. There are actually four sources of caloric expenditure. One is metabolism. Two is something called the thermic effect of food, which means that when you eat food, you don't absorb 100% of the calories, you absorb about 90% of the calories. And there is some nuance to that. The third source of caloric expenditure is exercise, no surprise to anybody. The fourth source is a big wild card. It's called NEPA, NEPA, which stands for non-exercise physical activity. It's movements we do throughout the day that are not formal exercise that still burn calories. For example, gardening. Gardening is not exercise. It's healthy for you, it's beneficial, but it's not exercise. Going for a walk, it's again healthy, beneficial, etc. Not exercise, but it burns calories. Housework, not exercise, but burns calories. All these little things add up to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calories throughout the day. And it's really the caloric expenditure that drops. Metabolism, by the way, is largely it's barely changed. Between ages 50 and 60, there is zero difference in metabolism. Only after age 60 does metabolism slow down by only about 4% per decade, not per year, per decade. And three of those 4% are simply due to the loss of muscle mass, and 1% truly due to aging. So you can mitigate the loss of muscle mass with simply proper strength training and an adequate protein intake. And so it's not so much that their metabolism slows down that much, it's more that their involuntary activity slows down. Maybe they're not twirling their hair as much. Maybe they're not bouncing their ankle. Maybe they're not clicking their pen. All these tiny little involuntary activities and movements, they can add up to hundreds of calories throughout the day. So if their weight was stable beforehand, they might have been eating 2,000 calories and burning 2,000 calories for a net effect of no weight change. After menopause, they must still be eating 2,000, but instead of burning 2,000, they're now burning 1,900 or 1,800. So now they're in a surplus, not maintenance.
Why is it that when people reach a certain age, they're doing less NEPA? Why?
Largely, it's due to simply a loss of muscle mass. Before, it used to be effortless. You'd bounce your ankle and your quads are moving, your calves are pumping, etc. And you're not really thinking of it. It's not something you consciously put into your schedule to do. 10 o'clock on Tuesday morning, let's do some ankle bounces. You don't really do that. But when you lose muscle mass, what used to be effortless becomes effortful. And so you don't even notice it. But these things start to diminish. But if you put in the effort into maintaining your muscle mass as long as possible through strength training and adequate protein, you can maintain your NEPA as well. So strength training and adequate protein is actually a double-edged sword. Not only does it maintain your metabolism, it also maintains your NEPA.
Isn't it true that the more we move, the more we move? So for example, maybe people as they get older aren't doing the NEPA because aches and pains or fatigue, whereas if they did it, they'd be more able to do it. Does that make sense?
Yes, somewhat. It's kind of true and kind of there is a bit more to it. So one reason that we don't do NEPA is, the drop in muscle mass. But just getting into the habit of doing NEPA, you what used to be subconscious now needs to become conscious. So there's a greater cognitive load. However, it's also when somebody has less muscle mass and more joint pain, NEPA becomes effortful. And so how does NEPA become effortless again? Simply by the reacquisition of muscle mass and muscle strength. So it's not enough to just do NEPA without strength training. It's better to do NEPA with strength training.
I totally agree, by the way. And I do strength training. We discussed it off air. I think it's actually crucially important for both men and women over the age of 50. But before we get to exercise, I want to talk about caloric intake. I'm personally of the view, and I'm somebody who has dealt with weight issues his entire adult life. I don't believe in diets. Where do you stand on it?
I'm with you for like 95% of people. There's a time and a place for diets, and but 95% of the time, there's better ways out there. So let's discuss both scenarios. When does a diet make sense? There is a tiny segment of the population who is scared enough because they either had a surgery or their doctor told them, well, you've got, if you don't change anything, you're going to die in 5-10 years, or they had a family member who passed away too early, and that scares them enough that they can go on a diet and stay on that diet for their entire life. That's a small segment of people. Another segment of people who can do well with diets is people who are doing it for the short term. For example, they have a beach vacation coming up, a high school anniversary, they're getting married for a second or third time or whatever. If somebody has a deadline and they don't expect to be eating this way past the deadline, diets can work. So that's the time and a place for it. Largely though, for 95% of the population in 95% of situations, diets make no sense. Because after all, how many of us have already been on a million diets before? All of us. And to paraphrase Mark Twain once said, quitting smoking is easy. I've done it dozens of times. And the same is true for weight loss. Losing weight is easy. I've done it dozens of times. And so if you've done it once, why do you need to do it again? Because you often regain it. And so that's the thing with diets. They make the assumption that the problem is nutritional, but that is only a surface level problem. The deeper reasons are why aren't we eating the way we know we should be eating? Because if the listener right now is older than the age of 5, they already know what to do nutritionally. They know to eat more protein, more veggies, less junk. No surprises to anybody. And every diet basically agrees on that. And so why don't we do it? It's the reasons are not nutritional. It's things like emotional eating, stress eating, cravings, planning, not cooking, traveling a lot, eating out a lot, etc. These are all the real reasons why we have a hard time sticking to diets. They're largely logistical, behavioral, emotional. We don't solve those kinds of problems with nutritional solutions. We need the right tools for the job, and nutritional tools are not the right tools for 95% of the people out there.
Okay, so you mentioned that weight loss is easy, and I think you meant that sort of relatively. In other words, yes. you know, as compared to, and this is the hard part, in my view, is maintaining weight loss. Because yes. your body is fighting you, right? And it requires more than like saying, okay, I'm going to diet for 2 months to fit into that bathing suit. It's what am I going to do for the rest of my life? Is that the way you see it?
Yes. Weight loss is simpler. Yeah. Weight maintenance.
Fair.
Because it's not easy. It's effort, struggle, etc. And even after you've lost the weight, it's a continuous effort to maintain that weight loss. But also psychology is so different. Weight loss is super motivating. Why? Yeah. Because you see progress. You step on the scale every week or every couple of weeks, you see that you're down a pound, a couple pounds.
Yep.
You tighten that notch on your belt. You see progress. However, nobody makes progress forever. Nobody gets to 0 pounds. Eventually, you get to your ideal weight and you switch from weight loss to weight maintenance. That is way less motivating because what's another word for maintenance? Well, stagnation.
Right.
Except in this case, stagnation is a good thing. And so the psychology of weight loss is very different than the psychology of weight maintenance. If you want, we can go into that, or if you want, we can move on to something else.
I find because for a lot of people, the struggle to keep the weight off is a lifelong journey. I find weight maintenance to be actually the more important of the two. And it's not sexy, right? Like there's no magic bullet for it, I don't think.
Yeah.
You know, it requires you to make certain choices. What are some of the things that you see that works with your clients in terms of weight maintenance?
So there are a few different strategies. First of all, you have to change your mindset from progress to maintenance, aka unfortunately stagnation. And how do you do that? Well, first of all, you have to have regular accountability. In other words, you have to have some way of measuring regression on a regular basis. Sometimes that's a scale. It's a very crude way of doing it, but if that's all you have, it's better than not using anything. Sometimes it's that notch in your belt. Sometimes it's the way your clothes feel.
Yep.
Obviously, my clients are personal training clients. We can go for the higher end stuff like body fat testing. If you see that you're getting even about 2 or 3% off track, it's time to have a plan of what to do when you get off track. And what does 2 or 3% mean? Well, if somebody weighs, let's say 150 pounds, 2 or 3% is only about 3 to 4 pounds. So if you're going up 3 or 4 pounds and you can't attribute that to one bad meal, it's a series of bad meals, it's time to put in the plan, the contingency plan of what happens when I get that far off track. Is it skipping dessert? Is it smaller portions? Is it something else? So it's good to have a contingency plan and having regular measurements. In addition to that, Exercise plays a way bigger role in weight maintenance than it does in weight loss. In weight loss, we like to say that it's 80% nutrition, 20% exercise, which, by the way, is a little bit different for women over 50. For them, it's more like 40-60. It's still in favor of nutrition. But that's another tangent. But when it comes to weight maintenance, it's more like 50-50, actually. Exercise plays a much bigger role, and somebody should be exercising 4 days per week or more. And when I say exercise, I mean actual deliberate exercise, not like I went for a walk, not like I went grocery shopping, not I went around the mall, but true, a combination of strength training plus cardio. Now, that's like non-negotiable, 4 days per week, etc. Now, if somebody wants to do more, they can do whatever else that they want to do that they still enjoy. If you want to play pickleball, by all means. If you enjoy hiking and you hike with enough vigor that it gets your heart rate up high enough, go for it. If you like squash, racquetball, tennis, etc., go for it. You like dancing, you can do that. It doesn't have to be formal exercise except for strength training. Strength training is a non-negotiable, and it has to be there. I'm going to go on a little tangent, and a lot of people think that strength training is defined based on the equipment. I'm using dumbbells, therefore I'm strength training. That is not the way strength training is defined. Strength training is defined based on intensity. If you're lifting weights heavy enough that you cannot do more than 15 times, you are strength training. If the weight you're using is so light you can do 16 or more repetitions, that is not strength training. That is cardio with weights. That's not a bad thing. Cardio is good for you, but it's not strength training. So those are some of the different strategies I use with my clients to help them stay on track once they've reached their ideal weight.
Let's shift to people over 50 and 60 in particular. I know you're of the view that we need less calories and more protein overall. Can you elaborate on that for a bit?
Yes. So there are only two things that drive body composition, two and only two, and that is calories and protein. Calories are king, protein is queen. Nothing else matters. Whether somebody has five small meals per day or two large meals per day, doesn't matter. If somebody eats after six or they don't eat after six, doesn't matter. Their hormones play a small role, but largely they don't negate the first law of nutrition. Calories, second law is protein. And so why is it we need fewer calories after 50 and 60? As I mentioned earlier, metabolism is very stable between 20 and 60. After 60, it starts to slow down. But even then, just 1% per year due to aging and 3% per year due to loss of muscle mass, which can be mitigated with strength training and adequate protein. And so the caloric requirements drop ever so slightly. If somebody is strength training, they only drop by about 1% per decade. So if somebody in their 20s needed 2,000 calories per day to maintain their weight, once they hit 60, they still need that amount of calories. But once they hit 70, they only need 1% less. That's 1980. That's a very, very tiny amount. The other thing we need more of is protein. Why protein? Well, calories just determine whether weight is lost or not. But protein determines what kind of weight is lost. Is it muscle or fat? And so with adequate protein, you hold on to muscle and you lose more fat. So that's one thing it does very, very directly. But another thing that it does is it keeps us fuller longer. So we don't have to use, you know, white knuckle iron willpower to eat less. We just feel like eating less. We don't have to use willpower or discipline to eat less. We just don't want that much food. That's another thing. And you know how earlier I was talking about the thermic effect of food and how it's about 10%? That's a very raw number. It's actually a little bit different between the three major macronutrients: carbs, proteins, and fats. If somebody ate 100 calories of pure fat, they would absorb about 97 or 98 of those calories. They would spend two or three of those calories digesting, absorbing, and assimilating the fat they just ate. If somebody ate 100 calories of pure carbs, something like bread or pasta or rice or potatoes, they would spend about 5 or 10 of the calories they just ate absorbing, digesting, assimilating those carbs. Now, if somebody ate 100 calories of pure protein, so some examples might be oysters, mussels, tuna, cod, stuff like that. If somebody ate 100 calories of pure protein, the thermic effect is 25 to 30%, which means that maybe 25 to 30% are being used on digestion, so only 70-75 are going into the body. So those are a couple of the great benefits of protein. One other great benefit is that with age, we get something called anabolic resistance. It's like we have insulin resistance, but anabolic means muscle growing stimuli. So muscle growing stimuli are things like, well, protein as well as strength training. Because we are less responsive to it, to anabolic stimuli, we need more of it. So people over 60 need between 25 and 30% more protein than people under 60 because they can't absorb it as well. And that's why that's the key. Lower calories and higher protein as a percentage of the total calories.
We have time for one last quick question. You mentioned the importance of weight training or strength training as people get older. What are your top tips for somebody who's embarking on a strength training program?
If somebody has never strength trained before, the first rule is just do it. The second rule is after you've been doing it consistently, properly, etc., for 3 months or more, then focus on optimization. Don't think I have to have the perfect program to begin with. Just think I want consistency. The motto is just do it and eventually do it right. So if you think I can do about an hour, you know, two or three times per week, do less than you think you can. Think 10 minutes. Three or four times per week. It's better than an hour twice per week, and then you're off track for, you're on track for 4 weeks, and then you're off track for a long time. It's better to do something consistently and frequently than something inconsistently and infrequently. So just start with something easy, simple, and just get into a rhythm.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Jamie.
That was Igor Klibanov. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Ashley Gutman is a senior physician at Seraphim Health with expertise in fertility, pregnancy, postpartum care, and perimenopause, taking a personalized and preventative approach to women's health. She earned her medical degree from the University of Toronto and completed her family medicine residency at McMaster University, helping patients navigate major life stages while supporting long-term wellness goals. Dr. Gutman combines evidence-based medicine with a holistic approach to care and is a member of the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and the Ontario Medical Association and Menopause Society. Welcome to the show, Doctor. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for that intro, Jamie, and so great to be here.
So when your people reached my people, and I really don't have people, I mean me, the idea that was pitched was talking about women who are pursuing motherhood independently, which I thought was like really interesting. I didn't know that was a thing, but I guess it is. Why are more women choosing motherhood without a partner?
That's a great question. And I really think there's a few things at play here. The first being women are just more independent than ever. Also, our idea of what the family unit looks like is evolving. And lastly, you know, women are just more aware of their fertility window and also their fertility options.
Can I add in one? Because it occurred to me, like, my kids are in their 20s and early 30s, and I think everybody's maturing later, if that kind of makes sense. Like, my cohort got married, like, really young compared to what's going on now, and finding partners becomes a lot harder in a digital society, where, particularly after COVID. And I'm just wondering if everybody's social milestones have been delayed, therefore sort of making that fertility window even smaller. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. And I think, you know, their social choices are also connected to, you know, more overall life choices, like, you know, focus on career development, you know, focus on higher level education, even personal growth. So I'm seeing a lot of that, you know, both in my practice as, you know, a family doc who provides care to a lot of women, and also in my personal life amongst friends and colleagues.
So what do you see as the emotional challenges of letting go of the traditional relationship parenthood timeline? How are people navigating that? And what are the problems that they may not be thinking of that arise?
Yeah, so this is definitely a challenge for some women who may sort of have a preconceived idea or sequence of events of how, you know, family planning comes to be. So it's that invisible checklist of, you know, you meet someone, you fall in love, you get married, and you have babies. And, you know, there's almost a grieving process that happens when, you know, some women realize, you know, that sequence is not the story for them. But what I see come out on the other side of that is, you know, almost a sense of empowerment and freedom that, you know, they don't need anyone's permission to pursue, you know, this huge life goal of starting a family.
How can women determine whether they're mentally, physically, and financially ready to be a solo parent?
So, you know, there's no easy or perfect answer to determine if, you know, they're ready or even if it's the right choice for them. You know, it's a deeply personal answer, and there's not really any checklist that can help you decide. What I found to be helpful is to sort of consider some of those deeper reflective questions. You know, for example, you know, if you were to picture yourself in the future and there were to be no child there, how does that make you feel? Does that feel more like a relief, or does that feel more like a loss? You know, another such question might be, you know, if you picture yourself carrying, you know, the emotional, the financial, the logistic load of parenting, which will mostly fall on you, no matter how much support you may have, you know, what would that look like and how would that feel? And, you know, the honest answers can often be more clarifying than any checklist would be.
Do you find yourself having conversations with your patients regarding this?
I do. And, you know, I think part of the advantage of being a family doctor and, you know, providing care is being able to, you know, bring up these important questions and concepts early on. So, you know, one of my pieces of advice for, you know, anyone who is thinking about family planning, regardless of, you know, the path or journey, is to book that preconception visit. You know, at Seraphim Health Clinic, which is my clinic, we do this all the time. You know, we bring women in and chat about their general health, including their physical health, their mental health, and, you know, make sure that, you know, they're armed with, you know, resources and education. And if they need any, you know, additional care, it's coordinated so they're as prepared as they can be.
I find it surprising that a woman wouldn't consider all these issues beforehand. Like, even if there was an overwhelming desire to have a child, you would still have to turn your mind to the practicalities. Or am I off base? Do people just like rush into this?
Yeah, so I don't find that people rush into it.
Okay.
But, you know, what I would always encourage, you know, women to do is really sort of consider the realities of being a solo parent. And, you know, some of those realities may be emotional. Like, we know parenting is tough. You know, there are certainly tough moments, moments of uncertainty. You know, you'll have days where, you know, I don't know what I'm doing days that happen to everyone. And, you know, as a single parent, that will fall mostly on your shoulders. So, you know, that's something that, you know, I encourage people to think about. You know, the financial realities deserve, you know, consideration as well. We know that raising a child is expensive, especially in those early years where there's childcare costs, there's time off work, and there's even financial considerations to the path to pregnancy itself. And, you know, of course, doing that on a single income is real. The good news is that there's lots of supports out there for women, you know, considering this path. There is, you know, supports for new parents. There are specific communities for single moms by choice. You know, there are financial supports. There are tax credits and subsidies. So, you know, the right planning is really helpful from the beginning.
What are some of the realities that women should be aware of if they're trying to have kids in their 30s and 40s?
That's a really important question, and that's a topic I find we don't talk about enough, especially in the primary care setting. I routinely ask all my young women at appropriate ages, of course, about their family planning goals. And not to scare them or stress anyone out, but more so just to open up the conversation as to, you know, is this something they've thought about before? Do they know what they want? Are they, you know, thinking about any timeline? And then we go from there because we know that fertility does start to decline in our 30s with somewhat of a steeper decline in our late 30s and 40s. So that doesn't mean that someone over the age of 40 can't get pregnant, but it may mean that it might be more difficult, take a longer amount of time, or, you know, they might require some fertility assistance. You know, there are other considerations as well. For example, you know, health conditions, especially certain gynecologic conditions, can put you at higher risk of fertility issues. And even the consideration of a woman who knows she wants to have a larger family of 3 to 4 kids, you know, based on that, this may be something she wants to think about and start planning for sooner rather than later.
Time for one last question, and that is, what are some of the family building options that you see in your practice that people may not be aware of?
So thanks to, you know, developments in assistive reproductive technology, there are a lot of options for fertility preservation and also family building options that are available to so many people. You know, one common example that we chat about is egg in embryo freezing. So this is ideal for a woman or a couple who, you know they want to have kids, but they might not be quite ready yet, and they want to delay their fertility but not compromise, you know, the quality of their eggs or embryos. When considering specifically, you know, single mom by choice or same-sex couples, you know, there are different options and they vary in terms of, you know, their medical steps, cost, and even like emotional considerations. So, you know, things like sperm donation with IUI, in vitro, intrauterine insemination, sperm donor with IVF, even surrogacy or adoption. And what I would say is a great place to start is see your family doc, open up the conversation about fertility. I know myself, I have a very low threshold to refer to my fertility colleagues to further the conversation.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Jarena Elbers, MD, MS, is an integrative neurologist, program director of the Trauma Recovery Project at the HeartMath Institute, and medical director at HeartMath. Her work focuses on nervous system dysregulation and trauma, chronic stress, and complex medical conditions. Dr. Elbers bridges clinical neurology with HeartMath's research on heart rate variability and coherence training, helping translate physiological science into practical, non-pharmacological tools for resilience. She specializes in understanding how autonomic imbalance affects cognition, mood, and long-term health, and how coherence training can help restore stability and emotional regulation. To learn more, you can visit heartmath.com. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So we're going to talk about stress today, because my personal opinion is we collectively in North America are under tremendous amounts of stress. And I think it might be different than the kind of stress that maybe our parents had and our ancestors had, right? What do you think has changed, and why are the traditional coping strategies no longer enough for many people?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think that, you know, our parents were lucky in a way. They didn't have all the technology, the speed that we live in today's world. And I think there's a lot of reasons why stress is different. I think even just talking about stress doesn't really cut it anymore. I think a lot of people are really experiencing overwhelm. And that's slightly different physiologically, actually. But, you know, we used to have more downtime. There used to be time in between where our nervous systems would have a chance to sort of relax, reset, unwind. There was more time in the day, more time to talk with people, more time to sit. You know, we used to have siestas. So I think that our system now is just as soon as, you know, we get up in the morning, we're on. And, you know, the drive is filled with, you know, ruminating thoughts or upsetting podcasts or the news or, you know, things that are activating for us, even though we might be sitting down. Our emails, we're always sort of trying to get to the next thing, trying to rush, and our kids. And I think because of our stress levels, we don't get along with people as well. And so arguments are more common. We might not get along as well with our colleagues, our partners, our children. And so all of these things sort of accumulate. And stress is cumulative. And our nervous system really, for resilience, requires rest. So it's about a cycle of sort of stress, recover, stress, recover. That's what builds flexibility in the nervous system. And we're just not doing that anymore.
So stress can be triggered by external events or doom scrolling or whatever, but it isn't necessarily the cause. You know, our emotions like worry and frustration or resentment or even self-doubt are factors. How should that change the way we think about stress management then?
Well, so, you know, part of it is in the language. We talk about stress and most people think about the outside influencers, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. The stressor is how I sort of differentiate it. Because for me, stress is the physiology. It's what's happening on the inside, not what's happening on the outside, because everybody's different, you know, and what might be stressful for one person is not stressful for another. And so the issue is what is the status of your nervous system? How activated is your nervous system the majority of the time? And I kind of see it on a continuum. You know, you kind of wake up in the morning, you feel refreshed. You feel like you can sort of manage the day, hopefully. If you don't, then you're kind of already, you know, you're waking up stressed or you're not sleeping well. Your system is already almost at capacity. And so when you have something come at you, like a distressing email, or you're sitting in traffic and, you know, something happens, you know, we need to be able to manage it. And that's part of sort of our, you know, we're not designed to not have stress. We're designed to be able to respond to stress, have the physiological response, right? Raise our heart rate or blood pressure, meet the moment, right? Have that energy moving into our systems, and then recover again. And when we're not doing that, that's stress. So that's when our system is constantly stressed, is that constant sort of fight or flight or survival mechanism. And that's the part that I like, you know, when we talk about what is stress, it's when that system is constantly activated in the body.
Many common stress relief activities may provide, you know, temporary relief, but don't necessarily address the root cause. What separates short-term stress relief from genuine stress resilience?
Yeah, so, you know, we kind of need to think about stress management like nutrition or fitness, right? And if you only eat your, you know, vegetables and whole grains once a week, but you eat fast food and junk food for the rest of the week, we're kind of losing the benefit, right? And so stress management is kind of the same thing. If we might take a hot bath a few times a week, or we might go out with a friend once a week where we feel good and we laugh and, you know, we can relax a little bit, or we might go on vacation once a year, right? And that's sort of it. Then we're not getting, those are these sort of temporary, but we're not moving through our day with these moments where we can get that recovery. And the system needs more recovery time. That we have this part of our nervous system called the parasympathetic, the vagus system. Some people may have heard of the vagus nerve. This is the physiology, is that nerve is responsible for rest, repair, digest, regeneration. And that's the system that needs to be coming on more often, and that we're not allowing that system to come on more often. And so if we're not sleeping well, that system isn't working well enough. And those are often the first signs that we're too stressed, is that sleep starts to become an issue. And so when our system is not resting effectively, when it's not digesting effectively, when we're getting sick more often, that's the sort of repair function. When we're not, we have, you know, a lot of allergies, that's our immune function. When our system is not doing those things effectively, that's a signal that that part of our nervous system isn't activated, and that stress is taking its toll.
So are you advocating for a daily sort of de-stress program? Or are you saying that we should be doing certain things to help regulate our parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems that perhaps we're not doing at all? Or is it both?
Yeah, well, I think that's the conversation, right? It's these temporary things that we do once in a while. It's not enough. It's not enough for the amount, the load that we carry now as a society and individually. And so that's why what we've done in the past, it isn't working anymore. And so, you know, this is why I really talk to patients about sort of a daily sort of stress reliever. So taking some time. And I think that a lot of people, they use their phones. Oh, this is my downtime. I'm going to go on my phone. I'm going to doom scroll, or I'm going to read the news or whatever. I'm sitting down. Right? And this is like, just because you're sitting down doesn't mean that your system is in that rest, repair, digest mode. Because emotionally, if you're in upset, if you're in worry, if you're in resentment, or in rage, those are affecting your physiology. Those are activating your stress system the same. So all of that doom scrolling, if it's activating any of those emotions, that's going to be activating your stress system in the background. So that we have to look at what we're doing and the frequency at which we're doing it. And so I like to sort of talk to people about, what's your emotional diet? You know, what emotions do you live in throughout the day? Because that's part of our physiology. It's just like what we eat affects our health and, you know, our physiology. Our emotions are doing the same thing. And so what emotions do you cycle through throughout the day? And where might we be able to put in some things, like as you're driving, can you appreciate something? Can you appreciate?
I cannot. I cannot do that. I have to tell you, you've hit a trigger. Toronto traffic is brutal, and
this is true.
And I'm a maniac, and I admit it. And I've discussed it numerous times on the show. I live. How shall I put this? Even though I'm Mr. Health and Wellness, I live in a constant state of stress. And I'm wondering, like, let's short circuit this conversation a bit. So if somebody's not really doing enough, What's an easy way? What's something they could do on a daily basis? Are you looking at meditation? What are you looking at? Exercise?
Yeah, so some, you know, you have to find what works for you. I think everybody is different. And so, you know, meditation is great, but I know a lot of people, I don't meditate. I can't meditate.
Me neither.
It's
I hate it.
So if I don't think that meditation works for everybody. Now, mindfulness is a different thing. Like to right. be mindful of what am I feeling? What am I thinking? How, you know, can I adjust this? So if I'm ruminating and stressing about something, right, that's activating for me. If I need to solve a problem, then that's important, right? So there's intelligent stress or intelligent concern, right? If I need to worry about something and plan something out or organize something. But if I'm just ruminating or I'm, you know, thinking about how bad I did at that presentation or that, you know, that whatever at work.
Yeah.
That's something where we can, mindfulness is sort of the starting point. And I love that we've started being mindful because that's when we have agency. Is we have capacity to shift things. So instead of thinking about how terrible I did, can I think about, well, maybe I could, you know, what could I do differently next time? Or, you know, I did the best that I could. Or, you know, if sometimes I play the game, like if I had a friend who was saying this, what would I say to them?
Right.
Right. You did your best and everybody makes mistakes and it's no big deal. Nobody's going to remember this in the long run. You know, I think we're our own worst critics, but, or just taking a moment, you know, we say you stop and smell the flowers, right? Taking a moment, just appreciate the, you know, the weather or appreciate the flowers on the side of the road, even if you're in traffic, or appreciate that somebody did something nice for you or kind for you, or sending care to somebody in your life, thinking about a good memory. So these are important things that actually very quickly shift our nervous systems into that recovery, that parasympathetic mode.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show to explain that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. It was great to be here.
That was Dr. Jarena Elbers. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss pursuing motherhood independently on The Tonic.
Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Carol Osborne is a world-renowned integrative veterinarian and author, a pioneer in anti-aging medicine and longevity research for pets. She created and patented the original PAWS, Pet Anti-Aging Wellness System for Dogs and Cats. Dr. Carol holds both the dog and cat scientific patents. After graduating from Ohio State College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Carol completed a prestigious internship at the Columbus Zoo. Shortly after, she launched a very successful private practice and became the founder and director of the nonprofit organization, the American Pet Institute. Dr. Carol offers traditional veterinary care for dogs and cats with a softer, natural touch. In addition to traditional treatments, she highlights the importance of nutrition and diet specifically for each patient. She has been a frequent guest on Fox and Friends, The Today Show, Good Day LA, and Discovery's Animal Planet. She's also been featured in USA Today, The LA Times, Ladies Home Journal, Women's World in Style, and New York Daily News. She practices at the Chagrin Falls Veterinary Center in Chagrin Falls, Ohio, and she's a frequent guest on the show. Welcome back, Carol. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me, Jamie.
So it's that time of year, and I think we had you back to talk about this last summer, but it bears repeating. As things get hotter in North America, we have to be mindful of our pets. So for those who don't know, What are the risks of your pet suffering from a heat stroke?
Ultimately, when pets get very overheated, they can go into a coma, develop epileptic seizures, and even die. But you certainly don't want to let it go that long. I think a lot of people don't realize that, unlike you and I, Jamie, pets don't sweat. The only way they can lose heat is by open mouth panting. So they're a lot more subject to higher temperatures than we are. You know, and if you happen to own America's most popular dog, the Frenchie, or other dog breeds that have those flat faces, you know, pugs, Boston Terriers, Shih Tzus, even a lot of the boxers, their respiratory tract or their respiratory system is compromised by virtue of their breeding. So they are even more sensitive to higher temperatures.
When we're talking about higher temperatures, like, what are we talking about? What's the threshold where you might start to be concerned about your pet?
I think higher temperatures for dogs are going to be similar to that for you and I, 75, 80, you know, 85 and above. It is it's pretty warm. And again, depending on your pet's hair coat, you might have a Mexican hairless, but many people, especially these popular breeds, you know, they have plenty of hair. So they're walking around with a mink coat on, which causes them to be, again, a little more sensitive to the heat than you or I would be.
Right. So what are the circumstances where a pet might get overheated? Is it on a walk, or what are the types of things that you see that are problematic?
Well, when you're going for a walk, just general rules of thumb, in the summer, you want to take your pet out maybe about 7 in the morning before the sun rises. And again, maybe 7 or 8 in the evening after the sun sets when it's nice and cool. During the heat of the day, the best place for most pets is inside your home where it's cool and with any luck, air conditioned. So the direct heat of the day is very tough as far as parked cars. Gets hot really quickly inside a parked car. So that's a big no-no. If you're going shopping or running errands, the best place to leave your dog is definitely at home. You know, you're going for a walk. Remember, I tell my patients, if it's too hot for you to walk outside barefoot, it's probably too hot for your pet's feet as well. So you can get little booties, and there's different little things that we can use to help protect our pets' foot pads. But concrete, grass, turf, even sand can get very hot and burn those sensitive little foot pads, which we don't want.
Do our pets need hydration like we do? So if I'm going to walk in the heat, I'm going to bring some water for myself. How do dogs work? Do they need the same amount of water?
I think they need the same amount or maybe even a little bit more. So if you are, you know, going for a walk or whatever, it's always a good idea to take along some fresh water for your pup. You know, if you're at the beach, for example, remember that salt water is not an acceptable substitute for drinking water. And if you decide to go swimming, remember that not all pets can swim. You can get your pet doggy swimming lessons. And if you're boating, remember they make all kinds of great dog life jackets. And again, if you have one of these flat-faced breeds, you know, the little Frenchies, Bulldogs, those dogs do not do well in water. Mostly they sink. If you've got a Lab or a Retriever, you know, again, they were, you know, born to swim and love the water. So I think it's just, you know, using good common sense and being alert to things to look for. You know, if you see your dog panting, breathing very quickly, the tongue is hanging out, maybe he's drooling, and then he starts to get weak or wobbly, you know, bring him inside, give him something cool to drink. You can put him in a cool bathtub and just wet them down. And when in doubt, give your vet a call just to, you know, make sure everything is going to be fine. But, you know, walking your dog, that dog should be walking in front of you as opposed to behind you, so that you can keep an eye on him or her and be sure the pet is enjoying the walk and not getting overheated.
So I know that dogs in particular experience pain differently than we do. And, you know, the signs that they're in discomfort aren't obviously what human signs of discomfort would be. How do you know if you're your pet or your dog is in discomfort either from the heat or otherwise?
Generally, they might start panting, breathing heavily, becoming lethargic, not wanting to move. If you look at their gums, they might be bright red or they might become very pale. You know, if they fall down on their side or anything like that, then you know it's time to take a trip to the pet ER. But in general, any change from normal, when your pet's behavior changes in any way that isn't normal, that is a sign that you want to address and not ignore.
Pets are smart and they're intuitive, but sometimes they don't know what's right for them. So like you're on a walk and you're not experiencing that it's too far. Your pet really has no way of telling you that they've walked too far or they're tired, do they?
They absolutely do.
Okay, so how?
Your pet should be walking 4 to 6 feet ahead of you. They shouldn't be panting, and they should be, you know, enjoying the walk. As soon as they slow down or they start to walk behind you, that's pretty much a sign that the walk is over. So, okay. When they're enjoying that walk, they're walking briskly or trotting ahead of you, as opposed to, you've got the leash and the pet's 6 feet behind you, and it's you know, hard for you to keep track of what's going on. So you always want to keep an eye on your dog, make sure he's not breathing heavily, his tongue isn't hanging out of his mouth, he doesn't seem weak, he's not wobbly or acting confused, that he's just acting as he, you know, would any other day of the week, if you will. And if you are, you know, at a pool party or something like that, and you have labs or retrievers or the dogs that love to swim, you know, remember that dogs are just like children. And after 20 or 30 minutes in the water, they need a rest break so that they can relax, have some fresh water, you know, bring a little tent or some, you know, form of shade, so they don't get overexcited or overheated or overdo it, if you will.
If you think your pet has heat stroke, what's the protocol? What should you do?
Well, you want to bring him inside where it's cool. You want to offer something cool to drink. If you have a bathtub or a shower, you want to soak him down with cool water. And then you want to pick up the phone and call your veterinarian. If you have a little first aid kit on hand, a normal dog's temperature classically is 105 degrees Fahrenheit. When your pet's temperature is above 104, that's a caution. So if you have a thermometer, you can check that. Otherwise, just give your vet a call or, you know, the local ER.
This may seem obvious, but how can we prevent our pets from suffering from heat stroke? What are the things that we should do to protect them?
Well, be aware of the temperature. Take your dog out for a walk before the sun comes up and after the sun sets. If you are out swimming or at a party or whatever it might be, keep an eye on your dog, that your dog, you know, isn't panting, his tongue isn't hanging out, he's not acting weak, wobbly, you know, or restless. So that he's, you know, acting normally and enjoying himself, and you're going to be just fine. You know, never leave your dog in a parked car. You know, if you're at the pool or the beach or on a boat, you know, be sure that you're right there with the pet. Be sure your pet can swim before you go to a pool party. If you're boating, make sure you have a nice little doggy, you know, light life jacket. And for the most part, just use good common sense. You'll be fine. You'll have a great summer. If you're creative, you can make a water park out of your backyard, get a little kitty wading pool, a little sprinkler, and some of those great water toys that they have. And you'll all have a wonderful time.
So I don't think there's any dog owner that would want their pet to suffer. And it's just common sense that you would want to make sure that they're okay. But there's also legal obligations to do so too, right?
Well, basically, if you see a pet in a locked car, it's something that you want to address, because that's very bad situation that it can actually become fatal. So I think about 30 different states have actually passed laws on that. But again, if you see something that doesn't look right, or a pet in a locked car, you know, address it, call the local authorities or whatever you need to do, you know, so the pet doesn't suffer.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show to explain that today.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Igor Klibanov, Dr. Jarina Elbers, Dr. Ashley Gutman, and Dr. Carol Osborne. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you know you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you are interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin, wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.